This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
This is the response by Professor Andrew Gamble to the talk by Nicholas Wapshot.
Yes, well, thank you. Thank you, Nicholas, for a wonderful talk and giving us a real flavour of Keynes and Hayek and their and their differences. The book is well worth reading. It's full of all kinds of stories about Keynes and Hayek, which are extremely entertaining. The one that I particularly liked, which I didn't actually know before, was Hayek was, of course, in Cambridge for much of the war when LSE was moved to Peterhouse, of all places, for the duration of the war. And Keynes found Hayek rooms in King's, and I knew that much, but I hadn't realised. I mean, I always liked the thought of while Keynes was busy in the Treasury saving the working out how to run the British war economy and planning for post-war reconstruction, that Hayek was busy sitting in King's writing The Road to Serfdom. But the story I didn't know was that when there was fears that Cambridge might be targeted by the Luftwaffe in retaliation for British bombing of German historical cities, that the Hayek and Keynes went up onto the roof of King's Chapel with shovels in case incendiary bombs were dropped on King's Chapel, and then their job would have been to get hold of the bombs and tip them over the side so they wouldn't burn through the roof. And the thought of Keynes and Hayek, I mean, I think they'd have been, both of them would have been completely hopeless if actually, if incendiary bombs had actually landed. So I think one of the things that comes out of Nicholas's talk and of his book, what he shows is just how intertwined these two figures have become. Nicholas talks about this being the clash that defined modern economics. I'd put it rather differently. It seems to me it's not so much for the clash for defined modern economics, but that define modern political economy. Because the economists, economics by and large, has moved away from both Keynes and Hayek, so that neither of them are any longer taught in most economic faculties around the world, in mainstream economics. And when Keynes got the Nobel Prize, ostensibly for economics, but really for politics, in 1974... a lot of economists didn't know who he was. And the and I had experience of this 2 or 3 years ago at a conference which was called on Hayek in the European University Institute in Florence. And the we had a number of papers from historians and from political scientists philosophers on Hayek, all taking Hayek fairly seriously and analysing his thought and his influence. And then the economists at the some economists at the European University Institute came along, and they said, "Why are we talking about Hayek? There's really nothing of interest at all for modern economics." And one of them, who had been a PhD student of Robert Lucas, had actually emailed Robert Lucas, and Robert Lucas sent an email to say, there's nothing in Hayek for modern economics. And it's this sense that both, and Lucas says the same things, of course, about Keynes, except if you're in a foxhole, but which is a quote that Nicholas has in his book. There's that sense that modern economics is not interested in either Keynes or Hayek, and yet these two figures are still of enormous of enormous importance. And I think the reason to understand that is less because of their theoretical clash in the 1930s, after Hayek had come to England, been brought by Lionel Robbins to counter Keynesian economics, that it's less that the theoretical clash in the 1930s as the political clash, and the political clash wasn't perhaps as direct between the two of them as the theoretical clash, but it's reverberated ever since. And it's interesting to think about the contrast between them, that Keynes, so much the public figure, so much of Keynes's life, I mean, only a part of it was spent actually in the academy. He had so many outside interests, and whenever he was allowed, he was at the heart of government, and was very influential both in the First World War and in the Second World War in shaping British policy, and left, of course, a lasting policy legacy in the influence, the partial influence he had over the shape of Bretton Woods and the design of the post-war international financial architecture. So you have Keynes, this extraordinary public figure. Hayek, who would have liked to have been a public figure, but because of the circumstances of his career, never actually became a public figure, and indeed in many ways was not cut out to be one. And Hayek has this a much more conventional academic career than Keynes, spends most of his life in universities, most of them publicly funded, and yet Hayek has this extraordinary turn in his life, in that the first, very unusual for an academic, that he spent the first half of his life as an economist, and then at around the age of 45, he suddenly leaves economics behind and spends the second half of his life thinking about political philosophy and political institutions and political theory more generally, and almost has this second intellectual career. But what he shared with Keynes, although he didn't share Keynes's involvement in practical affairs, what he shared with Keynes was this deep sense of political economy. He also shared with Keynes. They both had an elitism. They both had a disdain for democracy. It was different. In Keynes's case, it was that Keynes believed that the intellectual elite should rule. Keynes had huge contempt for most politicians that he came across, but he nevertheless believed in the idea of an enlightened elite that could provide wise policy and guide the nation. Hayek, of course, had a deep reservations about democracy, because he always feared that democracy would invade, that democratic governments would invade the market order and would destroy the basis of liberty. So Hayek spent a lot of his time thinking of ways in which in which democratic states could not, democracies could not actually function as democracies. And one of Hayek's practical legacies, Nicholas has mentioned the Mont-Pelerin Society. Hayek, in the second half of his life in particular, was the inspirer of various associations, various groups, and various think tanks who became crusaders for the cause of economic liberty, of libertarianism, of liberal conservatism, and various other causes. So that the Institute of Economic Affairs in Britain and organisations like the Heritage Institute in the United States or the Cato Institute, a lot of these were either set up by supporters of Hayek or Hayek came to have a very big influence within them. And I think the sense of Hayek and Keynes as political economists is, as Nicholas was saying at the end, that you see it most clearly in the great financial crisis and depression of the 1930s and now the situation today. One of the reasons why Hayek and Keynes have roared back into to public attention is because of the kind of crisis that is currently being faced has many similarities to the crisis of the 1930s. And it's remarkable how so many of the political arguments are coming back again. And again, as Nicholas was saying about the Tea Party, it seems to me very interesting some of the statements for the Tea Party, they repudiate the New Deal. They want to go back to Andrew Mellon. They believe that Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of the Treasury in the 1920s and at the time of the Great Crash, that Andrew Mellon gave the right advice to Herbert Hoover when Andrew Mellon said to him, liquidate the stocks, liquidate the real estate, liquidate labour, liquidate the farms, liquidate, purge the rottenness from the system, purge the rottenness. This was also the position that Hayek took and developed. And the Tea Party, in wanting to go back to Andrew Mellon, Andrew Mellon's response to the Great Crash, they have resurrected that position so that their argument is that the bailouts that George Bush began and Henk Paulson were quite the wrong way to go because they postponed the moment when the crisis could be solved. So what you find and of course Keynes in the 1930s took exactly the opposite approach. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, Keynes's political position has always seemed to me a strange one to pin down because in many ways Keynes was highly conservative, but Keynes's whole purpose in intervening in the capitalist economy was actually to preserve the capitalist economy, was actually to save it. He wasn't a radical in the sense that he was trying to pull it down any more than Henk Paulson was a radical when he intervened to save the American banking system from collapse in 2008. In other words, Keynes's whole motivation was to find ways that capitalism could be preserved and could retain its legitimacy. Keynes was concerned that if capitalism could not provide full employment and could not provide growth, that it would lose support and it would be and the liberal society which he prized above all else would be lost. And it was for that reason that Keynes advocated using the powers of the state, using the state in limited ways to help to preserve capitalism. And Hayek, of course, believed that Keynesian methods in political economy, that Keynesian methods would actually lead to the destruction of capitalism because the state would gradually encroach more and more and destroy the foundations for a true capitalist economy and capitalist society. And it is this utopian character of Hayek's thought. Keynes was never a utopian. He was He was a pragmatic statesman who looked to repair things and looked to the most sensible policy in the circumstances. Hayek had very clear principles and was unflinching in applying them. So Hayek was quite prepared to see the economy collapse and to have very severe depressions as the quickest way to restoring the fundamentals of the free society which he wanted. But it's this intransigence in Hayek and his belief in a set of very clear principles for the ordering of modern capitalism that appealed so much to later Hayekians and to certain politicians. It's the thing which attracted Margaret Thatcher. It's the thing which attracted Ronald Reagan. It's the thing which attracted Augusto Pinochet. So the Hayek provided a set of clear beliefs and principles, a clear set of lines in the sand, which, as Nicholas points out, many other people in the libertarian movement have said, oh, but no, he didn't. It's all sort of blurred, and it's much better to have to go to Ayn Rand or Murray Rothbard or some of the anarcho-capitalists, because they are the people that have really firm principles. Hayek was enough of a realist, actually, that he was a deeply political thinker, but he was the kind of political thinker whose cast of mind was to he believed that there needed to be fundamental and radical change. In that way, he was the real revolutionary. Keynes was not the revolutionary. Hayek was the revolutionary who really wanted to transform the world, roll back the state, and create a very different kind of capitalism than the one that had emerged in the 20th century.